that I can't say, lay me over the center line and the car hits me, who's going to get hurt? It's not going to be me, it's going to be the general public. But yet I, as a driver, fight against it and can't get anything done.
Yeah. Well, what I'm trying to say to you right now, Dennis, is the fact that in every law, there has to be some exceptions. And in every area, the rules are going to have to be just a little bit different. So we as a committee will be working on some of these things to attempt to convince DOT that some of these exemptions need to be.
I guess my main point is we would like a little input. And then, like I said, if you have the input, listen to it.
Right.
Use whatever.
That's one thing I'm very distressed about. We've all been discussing today quite thoroughly about the innate inability of bureaucracy to listen to us.
Mr. Swanson, in the job that he has, he says, I have a cabin down on the Kenai River in Cooper Land. He says, and I drive that road. I said, yeah, you drive that road in the summer. I said, I'm not some fly-by-night. I've lived here all my life. I was born and raised in Seward, and I've been working for almost 20 years driving a truck. Now, he drives down there in the summertime, and he has no complaints against it. I do. Who has to say so? He did.
Yeah.
I want something done about it, but I don't know how to go about it.
I don't either, but unless you and I talk, we'll see if we find
out. Well, I'd like to. We've got to do something.
I'm very encouraged
by what I saw here today.
Yeah, I didn't realize you were concerned.
You got it.
In other words, I'm your representative, aren't I?
Well, I don't live there now. I live in Anchorage.
Oh, okay.
But I'm saying
well, what part of Anchorage?
Seward, I've been.
Yeah, there. What part of Anchorage do you live? Is Mark who you represent?
No. I was born and raised in Seward, and I've lived in Alaska all my life and have no intentions of going anywhere. I'm not somebody that came up here and just learned how to drive
on
Alaska
highway. Right, yeah. But let's get together and talk over those things and see if we can find some type of solution, or at least a method to go about looking for a solution.
Can you give us some...
Yes.
Can you just give us some of this in writing so we can have it in terms of the permitting system and the possible...
If anything would be done about it, I'd be glad to do it. So far, I've been shoved aside.
You haven't called the transportation office.
The commissioner of the Department of Transportation wouldn't even return my phone call. And it's not NAP, it was the one previous to him when they first issued his permit.
No, that was Ward.
Casey.
Or Casey, yeah. But I think it was Ward, though. Casey wasn't in there long enough to answer any phone calls anyway.
He's in there long enough to do a lot of damage.
Yeah. I'm going to call a 10-minute recess, and then we'll come back. So, we'll recess for 10 minutes.
You got a car that's ready to change.
I've got a lot of pressure.
Oh, sure.
Okay, you're doing good.
I've been down the lower 48th, and I get dusted all the time down there.
If you need me for anything,
thank you, Harry.
Call me at that number, okay?
Oh, you're with Anna now.
Yeah.
Oh.
I got to tell you something. Have you ever met Ernie Keener?
Not that I know of. Who's he?
Well, I went out yesterday. There's a little advertisement in the Kentucky Fried Chicken about Lionel Trains. And I went out, and this guy has absolutely the biggest collection of Alaska Railroad trains I've ever seen.
I'll be damned.
Unbelievable. He's got pictures. He makes his own designs and all this kind of stuff.
Is that right?
I mean, God, sensational. And I'm not a model train buff, but I'm really impressed with that thing. In fact, I was thinking about going out and buying a little. I got an Alaska Railroad set. Okay, and I was just going to add a car to it. I got out there and spent $4,000 or $5,000.
Yeah.
Not even walk away.
How's Dave Moreland doing? Pardon? How's Dave Moreland doing over there?
Oh, good.
I did a little bit of consulting work for some guys that ran that disorder station up there in the summer. I got up there and I got to meet some of the folks that live in Scooter.
They're shut down.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
They're selling I think the bank's going to get ready to sell it. It's in a... You know, they tried to live past the tourist season. You can't do that with that station up there unless you make some significant in improvements money-wise.
Yep.
Well, take care, Tony.
Marco, I liked your letter. I really did. I was just going to offer one change in that right there at the end when it was, you know, the other person.
So what do we owe them?
And that's all that's known. And you do that.
I just
tell them
you're
trying
to change the regulation. The one that you want to fix it so much more dramatic.
I didn't really have any problem with that. I just thought that we should have said
a different environment.
Reporting not adopting regulations that DOT is not listening to the EG. There are taking time to testify.
I've been a productive citizen.
They might think that I just switched it up.
This meeting is recessed until tomorrow, Wednesday, November 18th, 9 a.m.,
1985. Did you hear that, Dick
Schultz? Yes, I did. 9 a.m. I'll be here at 8.
Is Joe going to come, Reed?
Yeah, he'll be.
Swanson's going to come after all. And, because he has been helpful to the
air industry. Is there some reason you're not answering the phone?
Well, Wednesday, December 18th, 1985, we'll reconvene from our recess from yesterday. And the first thing on our agenda, has everyone got the report, Wendy?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On Essential Air Service. We will continue on. Mike, are you in Fairbanks?
No, we're having difficulty getting him hooked up.
Oh, okay.
We've had a changes of...
Davis is gone?
Yeah, he had to leave last night.
He was going to hook up, he decided to hook up at his office and it wouldn't work, so now he's going back to the information office.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm going to chew him up about being late.
Yeah, you do that over. We're not hooked up for teleconference. We're merely hooked up for Mike up there.
I've lost touch with this issue. We have somebody kind of close.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to call on Reed to bring you, because I'm not quite as conversant with it as I should be, and so in just a minute we'll call Reed and have him. You have our report, don't you, Reed?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I'll
be back. Oh, that will be absolutely great. All right, would you come up and give your name and everything for the tape? And give us a summary. We'll go through this.
Okay, thank
this
you,
Matt.
For the record, my name is Reed Stoops, and I'm here today to represent the Alaska Air Carriers Association. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for its cooperation last year in helping us to get House Bill 133 passed, and also in its work to help fulfill the requirements of the letter of intent which went with that legislation. Wendy Chamberlain's done a lot of good work during the interim, and we've also tried our best to cooperate with the Senate Transportation Committee, and I think we've had at least reasonably good success in doing that. Just by way of review, the House Bill 133 last year established the minimum insurance levels that would be required for various classes of air carriers, and in addition also dealt with truck safety. We're here just to deal with the air carrier's portion of the bill. Along with that legislation, there was a letter of intent that dealt with 4 points, and there was directed a report to come back to the legislature by the beginning of the next session. The issues to be dealt with in that report included, number one, what federal safety regulations are applicable to Alaska intrastate air commerce, and which, if any, ought to be incorporated into state certification of compliance programs. Just a brief summary, what was meant by that was that right now you have federal regulations which govern commuter airlines, but once ATC was thrown out, there was really no regulation in effect anymore to govern your charter operations. Under the bill that was passed last year, established minimum insurance levels for air charter operations in addition to what's required under federal regulation for the commuters. But there's really no other requirements. So that was designed to take a look at what safety-related requirements, if any, should be considered in the future if it turned out that one of the effects of deregulation was a decrease in safety. At that point, in a few minutes. The second point was whether flying conditions in Alaska warrant additional safety training for pilots. Is that something, is the weather or conditions of airstrips unusual enough up here that the federal regulations aren't sufficient in order to qualify somebody for flying people for hire?
Yeah.
Still a little...
Meeting is starting
at the, as soon as we
present
the
thank you very much. I was just checking to be sure everything was okay.
Anyway, this, there was some statistical data that I'd be glad to cover on that point. There was also a provision dealing with the Essential Air Service Program, which is a federal program which is scheduled to be phased out next year, and there's an analysis of that program and what some of the potential impacts of the phase-out would be. And then last, there was a look at how the Department of Commerce implemented 133 during the interim.
Question?
Yes. Okay. Representative Schultz.
On page, whatever it is, page 2 there. These air carriers that are presently receiving this subsidy, are you saying that that is going to go by the wayside?
Right. President Reagan proposed last year in the fiscal year 86 budget that that be phased out as part of federal cost control measures.
What's going to...
Senator Stevens and Murkowski were able to get that funding back in for one more year, but at this point everybody seems to think that there's a pretty good chance that fiscal year 87 program is gone, in which case Alaska Airlines will not receive a subsidy to provide jet service into Cordova, Yakutat, Petersburg, Wrangell, I think those are Gustavus, those five communities, and there'll be no money for rural service on Kodiak Island, Western Alaska, places that don't get a minimum of 2 trips per week.
Okay, now this subsidy, though, is primarily for mail, is it not?
No, it's 2 separate programs. The post office runs a program that provides contracts to various carriers to carry the mail. That's a separate program for mail only, and indirectly, that does have an effect of subsidizing passenger service, provided that the air carrier runs passengers. They could do it just as a cargo service, but assuming they do it as passenger service, they carry passengers on the mail run as well. But the other program is separate and distinct, and it was intended to make sure that communities received a minimum of 2 trips per week. And if no carrier was willing to do that under the normal environment, commercial environment, then they could apply to the federal government, and they could, on a competitive basis, they could be awarded a contract to subsidize the cost of flying in there twice a week to make sure there was a minimal level of service. And in the report, Wendy's included what the minimum level of service is for each community in the state, and then which communities are receiving that subsidy and which carriers are now serving those communities. Just in summary, there was about $4.5 billion appropriated last year, of which Alaska Airlines got the majority, $3 million for the jet service, and then there was about another $1 to $1.5 million that went to the rest of the state. I think 16 communities in the Kodiak area were subsidized, and a number in western Alaska, a few in Prince William Sound.
Might I ask you a question also?
Sure.
Reed, I was just on Seward, and I was talking to Ludwig's wife, I can't think of her name, for Harbor Air, and they, evidently that contract came up for bid 3 or 4 times, and Chisholm had it, then Chitna had it, and finally Harbor Air had it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Harbor Air applied for that on the program that you're talking about that just had to do with the mail, am I correct?
Well, they would have applied to the post office, and that part of the program is still in effect. Senator Stevens has done a good job in keeping that alive.
That part is still...
Right, and they have changed the way they've done it, so now that's a competitive process as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, on the Essential Air Service Program, at this point, we haven't... The basically an overview that's provided for you, a good overview, and we haven't, the air carriers haven't really taken a position on future funding for that at this point. And I suppose we'll deal with that at some later point, as may be obvious. At least on the southeast run, there'll be some of the smaller carriers interested in providing service on a competitive basis. Obviously, Alaska Airlines will want to continue its jet service, so I'm not sure how we're going to work that out amongst ourselves. And as far as the bush routes, there may be support for continuing some form of minimal subsidy if we're going to have no air service at all. We haven't really dealt with that. We've concentrated more on the other aspects of the regulatory aspects of the study. Just go ahead.
Yes, Representative Finalberry.
Reid, I just wondered, has anybody given any thought or has any discussion been had about what happens if Alaska Airlines, for example, was to pull out of some of the southeastern communities? And the state in recent years has spent many millions of dollars in upgrading those airports at that airline's request. We put in landing aids, we paved the runways, lengthened the runways, built terminals. Sometimes the state expensive because I know they've built the terminals. But regardless of how the money was spent, I think it's irrefutable that the state has put a lot of upgrades into the airport in southeast Alaska. How would we recover that if they decide that it's uneconomic to serve those cities if the feds decide not to subsidize them?
I'm not sure that there would be any way to recover those.
They'll be able to take their place.
Well, yeah, I mean, it may be that there may be some jet aircraft that somebody else would be willing to fly in if Alaska doesn't. Alaska may continue flying jets without a subsidy. That's obviously difficult to ascertain. They have been active this summer lobbying communities to help them continue the subsidy at a reduced level, and I'm sure that during the next year or so, both the federal, they'll try to get a continuation of federal funding for that purpose, but as to whether what happens if the funding is cut off, I don't know if there's any way of knowing in advance exactly what Alaska Airlines would do. It's possible that they'd run jet service in the summer and discontinue in the winter or at a reduced level.
So we probably ought to hear from them.
Yeah. Summarizing some of the statistical information that's provided for you in the report, it's kind of interesting, based on what we've read in the newspaper today, at least it was my assumption that we're headed toward a record year for accidents. It seems that at least several times a month we read about another aircraft accident somewhere in the state. And as it turns out, in 1985 through the beginning of November, there were 40 accidents that have taken place this year, which is a significant number of accidents, but it's also lower than 1980, 1981, when we had 64 and 56 accidents, respectively. So while we're higher than we were in 82, 83, and 84, we're still substantially down from what we had in the early 80s. And the same is true of fatalities. There's been 23 fatalities to date this year in airline accidents, as compared to 29 in 1980 and 32 in 1981. Well, the year's not over yet.
Might I ask you a question at this point, Reid? These accidents, are they by charter air services, major air services, or small bush lines are just exactly?
There is a breakdown in the report that shows the number of accidents that were related to commuter or scheduled services and those that were related to charter services. The number of accidents in the charter services have been higher than the number in the commuters. Just as an example, in 1985 so far, six of the fatal accidents have been by air taxi operations. One has been by a commuter operation. But part of the problem is with the studies, and it's not the fault of the researchers, it's just that the information doesn't exist, is we can't really make a valid comparison because we don't know the number of miles flown or the number of hours flown by the commuters versus the air charter operator. So until we have that information, it's a little bit difficult to determine whether the air taxi operations are more safe or less safe.
things that we will recommend to you this next year is that cooperate with the federal government and try to do a better job at building a statistical base that we can make a good comparison on. Otherwise, we'll have no way of knowing whether it's a good idea to apply some additional regulations to the air charter operations or the scheduled carriers.
Carry through on the thing that I asked. Would you say that deregulation has had anything to do with the fact that they were regulated during 1981, 82, 83, and 84, and deregulation came into effect? Could this, by any chance, have anything to do with the increase in fatalities or accidents?
Madam Chairman, we, at the beginning of the year, we expected that that would be the case, that we assumed that, that deregulation would the air industry somewhat less safe because people there would be no longer any requirements for bases of operations for maintenance programs, some of the things that ATC used to do. The information we have at hand can't really demonstrate and make a case one way or another. We do know that there's more accidents. A number of those accidents have been by established carriers, as opposed to new carriers, but we really don't have the basis on which to make a sound judgment. At this point, I think that both studies, both the House and Senate studies, make that conclusion, and we have to agree with them that at this point we can't come back to you and say we want additional safety-related requirements put into 133 simply because we don't have the statistical basis on which to prove that those additional regulations would result in safer traffic. So we'd like your cooperation this next year to continue the study with our assistance try to get a better handle on whether we do need some additional pilot training or we need some additional number of hours or some way of assuring that when the passenger gets in that plane that we have the best possible maintenance programs and the best trained pilots we can have access to.
Representative Schultz?
Just wondering, you mentioned a while ago the increasing or of the insurance rates or the amount of insurance that the carriers have to carry. Are you getting, I heard it on the radio coming in about some carrier in Southeast or I don't know where, out Dillingham or something was having a problem with insurance. And I've had other air carriers talk to me about problems that they're having with the cost of liability insurance. Are you still, or are you guys getting a lot of feedback or a lot of complaints?
That's one of our priority issues that we've been dealing with it on a comprehensive basis, not only amongst ourselves, but along with all the other industries that are also having problems. It's not our position that we should reduce the amount of liability insurance that's required, because at some point the consumer deserves to be flying in an aircraft that's covered. So if there is an accident, there's some guarantee that they'll compensated for whatever injuries occur, but liability insurance in the industry is getting higher at the same rate as it is for the doctors and for the architects and engineers, for a number of daycare centers and other groups. Rather than trying to reduce the minimum, our approach is to join with other industries in suggesting some changes to the tort system so that we can try to deal with the issue comprehensively rather than just industry-by-industry basis.
Just out of curiosity, if I may follow up.
Yeah.
Curiosity, what is your feeling of, okay, having the maximum amount of liability insurance, but at the same time, what are your feelings of going in and capping the amount of liability insurance or the amount of that a person can collect? A finger is worth X number of dollars, a hand is worth, I mean, it's grim to say that a life is worth X number of dollars. An insurance company knows exactly where they stand. Going and putting a cap on the amount of money that lawyers can charge.
Those are two of the proposals that are being considered in a comprehensive solution. A cap wouldn't be a flat cap. The cap would be for for pain and suffering. We wouldn't suggest that there be a cap on what a person could recover just for compensation for wages and other things like that. But in addition to that, juries have awarded substantial settlements for pain and suffering, and that's difficult to quantify. We've had $1 million-plus settlements just for that aspect alone. We do agree that that a cap on that would be in everybody's interest, because right now the industry is just passing those higher insurance level, higher insurance payments sure. back to the consumer, not just by our industry, but the truckers. It has the effect of higher transportation costs across the board, higher medical costs.
Doesn't workman's compensation, don't they have a cap on if you go out here and working on a machine and you lose a hand,
a
workman's
schedule.
Comp, bingo.
Right, they have a schedule. That's one of the things we looked at in trying to develop a system. And it does have some merit in that there's some certainty if somebody's injured, rather than having to go through a long, expensive process to determine what the compensation would be. It'd be nice if there was a simple way of recovering an immediate amount of money, and then if there's going to be litigation after that, then fine up to some level. That's something that we've looked at, and so far we've come to the conclusion that a cap on pain and suffering would be the cleanest way to do it. But there is some merit to a workman's comp type approach if you could figure out how to cover the administrative costs for that. There may not be a lot of support for the administration that's necessary to run a workman's comp type program across the board for everybody. It's an interesting idea.
Might I interrupt for just a minute? Mike, are you there in Fairbanks listening to us?
You bet.
Okay, feel free to break in anytime you have a question, because you're still on the tape as being here.
Yeah, thank you, Betty. It's been pretty good transmission, except for one time Dick, Representative Schultz was fading out, but it's been excellent transmission. Thank you.
That's all right. Representative Schultz has just now discovered that he has a button on his mic.
Yeah, I have my mic on now, Mike. I was going to just make a note here. It's 9:45 here. I don't know what time it is there in Fairbanks. You might have been a little bit late.
There must be a hidden message there. I'm not picking it up.
Well, don't worry about it too much. Go ahead, Mr. Stoops.
Okay. Moving along to just a few comments on the status of House Bill 133. What's happened since the session was over last year is that the air carrier's portion of the bill, the responsibility was placed in the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce, the Commissioner of Commerce, assigned that responsibility to the Division of Weights and Measures, apparently for funding purposes. I think they felt that they had a better ability than some of the other divisions to deal with the clerical support that was necessary. And we have worked with Joe Swanson, who's the Director of Weights and Measures, to try to provide our assistance in making sure that the program was implemented as intended. There was a letter that went out late in the summer that notified the various carriers that this law had passed and that they were responsible to get a certificate from the state to assure that they did carry the minimum level of insurance that was now required, which was $150,000 per seat. And we had a provision in the bill, as you recall, that allowed the companies to acquire that new level of insurance when their old policy expired, so it would be staggered during the year. It wouldn't all happen abruptly upon the effective date of the bill.
Might I intervene again, Reed? What? How do you monitor, how do we monitor, how does anyone monitor the fact that air carriers are carrying insurance?
Well, the system that was contemplated was a real simple one, that we required carriers to submit to the state a copy of their insurance policy indicating that, number one, they carried 150,000 per seat for every plane that they were flying, and secondly, that there was a clause in that insurance policy that required 30 days notice to the state if that policy was going to be canceled, to avoid a situation where somebody cancels their policy and then just continues flying. So we assumed that it could be done through the mail. If the carrier did not submit it, then there was no basis on which to issue a certificate. We know pretty much which carriers are flying, because a lot of them are already registered with the federal government or have been registered in the past. So there's a list of carriers, although we may not pick up some of the new ones. and we're going to try it just on a, just try to do it through, you know, through simple administrative procedures. The first letter went out, and there was apparently about 20% of the carriers responded back and divided their copies of their insurance policy and received their certificates. But until the end of the year, it's hard to determine how effective what compliance ratio we're going to have, because a lot of the insurance policies don't come due until November and December. So until carriers aren't required to comply with the law until their insurance policies come due. So probably in another month, we'll know how many of the carriers in the state complied with the law just on the basis of one or two letters from the department. So hopefully, in the session, we'll be able to let you know how satisfactory that system has been working. The only problem area that I'd like to raise, you might want to talk to Joe about it, is that we had some difference of opinion over the enforcement language in the bill this last year, that early on after the session, we held a meeting to make sure that we were in agreement on how the bill would be implemented. Joe didn't feel that the enforcement sections were clear enough to allow him to aggressively enforce the bill. We had a somewhat different opinion, but we agreed to get a letter of or an opinion from the Attorney General's office.
Would you repeat that, please?
Okay, there was some difference of opinion over how enforceable the bill was, whether there were some different interpretations of two of the enforcement provisions on exactly how that would be done. And in order to clarify that, we sought an Attorney General's opinion to see whether we were right or Joe was right. And to date, we've never gotten the Attorney General's opinion back again, so we don't know who's right. But in the meantime, there's been at least one case of reports of carriers who've been flying without insurance, and unfortunately, it was a case where the federal government also had jurisdiction. They actively sought enforcement, but the state did not actively seek enforcement of the state law. So, you know, there may be legitimate grounds for that position, but on the other hand, we'd sort of like to see at least a letter going out from the state indicating that that carrier was in violation of state law, and you know, if it's unenforceable. Turns out that it is unenforceable because of lack of money or because of language in the bill, then we can correct that during the next session with the technical amendment. But we'd be happier if there was a more aggressive posture by the state.
Yes.
Representative
Finalberry.
Would you explain what the constitutional question,
It wasn't really a constitutional question. I don't know if Joe can address it when he comes. I think there were two problems. One is that if there was a violation, was it a violation per incident? In other words, if somebody carried passengers without insurance, do you fine them every time they made a trip with the passenger, or is it just one violation no matter how many times they flew with passengers? That was one question. And we felt that could be handled by regulation, but Joe wasn't comfortable with that. And then secondly, what's the recourse if you are caught? There's a fine, that's obvious, but whether or not you can issue a stop order to stop that person from flying until they have it, there's also a difference of opinion. We thought that the law said that you could do that, if there was sufficient authority. Joe said, we're not really sure about that. We think that all we can do is revoke their certificate of compliance, but we can't stop them from flying. And again, that wasn't our interpretation, but at this point, the state's position is that they weren't comfortable that they could enforce. So I think Joe can address those points. I guess we would have liked to have at least seen a letter go out saying that you are in violation and that we tend to take action if you don't cease flying until you acquire your insurance. But in the one case that we are aware of, the federal government did seek compliance, and apparently they've been effective. So that incident's been taken care of, but it's something that we do have to deal with, because we know that there's other carriers out there that are flying without insurance right now.
Reed, this is Mike Davis. I've got a question for you.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. When you say that carriers are flying without insurance, isn't that also a violation of federal law that they can't fly without insurance?
Representative Davis, it's a violation of federal law if they're a scheduled carrier, in which case they have to have $300,000 per seat in liability insurance. If it's strictly an air charter operation, there is no applicable federal law. It's only state law.
Interstate.
If they're flying within Alaska and it's only a charter service, only state law applies.
And you're saying that there's no enforcement then of the insurance regulations, and those that are in violation are not being cited?
So far, that's the case, and you know, we'll admit that it's early, that it is difficult for the department because of a lack of funding, and you know, there may be some legitimate differences of interpretation of the bill, but we're just raising the point to assure that in the future that there is aggressive enforcement, because it's in people's best interest, and we think it's in the industry's best interest.
Well, if I could continue, Madam Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Davis.
Well, Reed, does the industry have any suggested amendments or things that would make sure that the teeth, if there is teeth? The trucker said yesterday there's no teeth in the law. Do you have any recommendations, or are you going to bring any recommendations to the legislature so that the enforcement provisions are being ferreted out?
Yes, Representative Davis. In the in the packet that has been made available to the committee here, there is a proposed set of amendments that was prepared by Joe Swanson that I intended to deal with in the testimony today. There are two or three suggested changes in the enforcement language that we're prepared to support.
I have the packet, so if it's the blue folder, I have that. If it's in there, I'll find it.
Reed, do you have a page number that you're going to be...
No, I guess, hang on just a second, let me get the blue folder.
Well, Madam Chairman, when Reed takes a look at this, are you considering introducing some legislation that would be transportation committee legislation to address these issues and the ones that were addressed yesterday with the truckers?
That will be something, Mike, for the committee to decide, but yes, I very definitely think so. I don't think we want to open up 133, but I do think that we'll probably have to introduce some type of legislation that will take care of some of the problems that have arisen from that. From what I understand, it's primarily in funding, and then the decision is which agency is actually to do the enforcing, and we're going to have to, as a committee, make some preparation for that.
Well, Betty, if you would like any cooperation from me or any assistance before the legislature convenes on some of these issues, I'd be glad to work with you on that.
Well, I will certainly appreciate it, Mike, and we'll keep that in mind, and I'll be able to get in touch with you up there.
10-4.
Madam Chairman, the proposed legislation is not in the blue packet, I don't believe, but... It is. I got a copy from Wendy, so I'm sure that it's available. And as soon as we find Wendy, we'll...
Yeah, as soon as she gets back, she's busy on another errand right now. As soon as she gets back, we'll find it out.
Until we get copies of the legislation to deal with, I'll defer my specific
Here
comments.
Here she is now.
While we're getting copies of the some suggested amendments to the bill, this time I'd like to defer for a few minutes and allow Dave Zundel, who's the executive director of the Air Carriers Association, to talk to the committee just briefly about some of the work that the Air Alaska Aviation Safety Foundation is doing, how they're cooperating on the safety aspects of the study and what things they're doing to try to reduce the accident rate here.
Excellent. Mr. Zundel, would you like to come forward and give your name and occupation for the record?
This is on. Yeah. Madam Chairman, my name is David Zundel. I am the executive director of the Alaska Air Carriers Association, and and also the Executive Director of the Alaskan Aviation Safety Foundation. I'd like to speak on, kind of summarize what the Alaskan Aviation Safety Foundation has been doing in the last, particularly since October of 1985, but specifically also including a little bit of history of the foundation's beginnings and the funding that the state has given the foundation. Alaskan Aviation Safety Foundation was established in 1978 by the aviation industry to foster aviation safety by providing aviation training throughout the state. During the first few years, the foundation conducted aviation management courses, pilot and mechanic seminars, and chief pilot seminars, etc., between the years of 1978-1980. Then in September 1980, the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, published their special study, Air Taxi Safety in Alaska. The NTSB report clearly established an air safety problem, which indicated that the accident rate in Alaska was 4 times the accident rate for air taxis in the rest of the United States. The NTSB report concluded that there were 3 major factors that contributed to the high air taxi accident rate in Alaska. Number one, the Bush syndrome, an attitude on the part of air taxi operators, pilots, and passengers in Alaska that range from casual acceptance of risks to willingness to take unwarranted risks in Alaska, or risks when flying. Two, inadequate airfield and communication facilities. And three, inadequate weather observations and insufficient navigational aids. In June 1980, the Alaska State Legislature appropriated $51.3 million for further development of the state aviation system. Specifically, the money was for airport improvements and weather services. The other side of the problem is education of management, pilots, and passengers to overcome the Bush syndrome. Note, it is not just the Bush pilot syndrome. The NTSB report recommended to the Alaskan aviation industry the following: extend their safety program to reiterate the hazards of air taxi operations in Alaska to overcome, in particular, the Bush syndrome. The Safety Foundation began a study in 1980 to determine how best to implement the recommendations of the NTSB. Phase one of that was the completion of a report that was, by the way, funded by the state legislature through the Safety Foundation, a report by the American Airlines Training Corporation defining Alaskan aviation training requirements. This report was completed, again, through the funds provided by the state legislature. The study completed in July of 1980 was effective in determining a specifically designed training curriculum suited to the needs of Alaskan aviators. The next phase was to create such a curriculum. On September 13, 1983, the state contracted with the Safety Foundation to develop an Alaskan aviation safety curriculum that would include lesson plans to be used by experienced Alaskan aviators when training, or aviation operators when training both private and commercial operators to fly aircraft safely in Alaska. Dr. Jerry Cockrell was hired by the foundation to spearhead this project, and it was completed in the summer of 1985. Phase three of the program is the phase that we started in October of 85, and that was to conduct safety seminars throughout the state. We actually began a preliminary phase of the seminars, the safety seminars in Bethel. That was the first one we did, and that was done in April of 1985. Since October, the Safety Foundation has been involved in an aggressive program. We've been in Anchorage.